Welcome to another episode of Lamp Talk, a podcast where we discuss everything from lighting philosophy and technology to set politics and the business of owning lighting gear. I'm your host, Mac from Macum. For over three decades, I have had the honor of working closely with some of the best gaffers and manufacturers in Hollywood. Ron,
yeah.
Good friend of mine. It's nice to see you. We call him the card shark. We used to have these really great poker matches. We got to try to do that again, and you were really good at it, and it was just so much fun. And I can't wait to get back and doing that again. You know who's a good, you obviously know who's a good card player is Mike DiLorenzo.
Yeah, he and I have played cards for 40 years.
Yeah, I played with him early on. He whipped my butt.
Oh, yeah.
He seems to change the rules all the time every... Let's talk about how your father got into the business. So originally, he was in the Navy.
He was a radio man in the Navy, which sent code over the airwaves. And also, he used a carbon-burning arc on the destroyers that would signal from ship to ship or ship to shore. And it was a carbon-burning arc with a shutter.
So this is pre-movies.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this was 1925. Well, it wasn't pre-movies, but...
Before they used carbon arcs in the movies.
They started out using sunlight, just sunlight. Edison had developed the motion picture camera, and he also invented the first practical incandescent light.
Right.
But the problem was that the light wasn't intense enough to burn an image on the film.
Yeah, the ISOs were really low. What was it, like 20?
25, 50, you know. So they had to go back to the carbon-burning arc, which was basically 19th century technology. They used that because it was a balance for a daylight source. And, you know, at the time, all of the film was shot outdoor. And then they didn't put sound stages together because they wanted to eliminate the noise, the ambient noise and so forth.
It was silent pictures in the beginning, so you didn't worry about it.
Right. The first studio was Edison. He built a tar paper shack, basically. It was on a round table, so it would rotate. And they used sunlight.
As the sun moved, they would rotate the stage.
Right. Well, and they used glass to capture the light, and that's how they lit the stage. And the way that they got the word gaffer comes from the fact that they had these panes of glass and they'd adjust them as they moved the turntable and they moved the studio and they would adjust the lights with a long stick called a gaff.
Interesting. Wow. I never knew that. I'm sure a lot of people don't know that.
Yeah. Some of the studios, MGM, I think was probably the last one, but had glass roofs on the sound stages when they first started.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So your dad's working in the Navy, and he's working with Brute Arcs, and is that how it propelled him into...
It wasn't a Brute, it was an arc.
It was just a carbon arc. A
burning arc.
A burning arc, yeah.
They discovered that they could use that as a light source, and that's what they started using was a carbon burning arc.
Right. So is that how your father got into the lighting business?
Yes, he got paid off out of the Navy in 1925 in San Pedro and decided to stay here. The way he got in was he was driving truck delivering shrubbery for Germain Nursery to the studios, and they had a call up for anybody that could operate a carbon arc. So that's how he got into the studio business.
Wow.
That was way before Local 728 even existed.
Yeah, probably even ASC. ASC just came up on their 100th anniversary, a few years ago or a year or two ago? So they were like 1919. So yeah, about 6 years after.
Yeah. In order to be a radio man in the Navy, you had no electricity. So he had an electrical background and a carbon-burning arc background.
So he was a lamp operator. And what did he propel into after that? Did he work at a studio? Did he start gaffing?
He started as a rigger.
Like most legends in the industry do.
I mean, that's the way he started.
Right.
He actually met my mother on location in 1939. They were doing a picture in Eugene, Oregon, called Lincoln, Man from Illinois.
That's how you got into the picture. That's awesome. So you'd mentioned Thomas Edison developed the moving picture camera and the first light bulb. Was he originally involved in any companies here in Hollywood?
Edison himself?
Yep.
No, I think it was pretty much back east.
So did Peter Mole from Mole Richardson actually work for Edison?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they developed a line of carbon-burning arcs, even though it was Edison was trying to put the incandescent light source in there. It just wasn't intense enough.
Right, for the camera speed.
Right, and the Kelvin was way low. Mm-hmm. They developed a whole line of carbon-burning arcs all the way from a small size that we call a junior up to the larger lights, which is a 170, and it goes 170 amps.
And that's why they call it a 170.
The last step was the Brute, which was a 225 amp carbon burning arc.
And pretty much at that time, Mole Richardson was the only game in town?
No, there was other manufacturers, but Mole was the primary manufacturer of lighting equipment.
And so your father must have known Peter Mole.
They used to go out to the track at Santa Anita together. It's one owned the horses and the other bet on them.
Wow, so they were buddies. They were going out to the racetrack. They both loved horses and they both were in lighting. And your father was Peter's customer indirectly, right?
They only sold to the studios. They didn't sell to any independent gaffers or whatever. So, you know, he worked at most studios like I did. I think I've worked at every motion picture studio in the business.
So you started in the business in what, in 62?
62, yeah, it was my first call, Warner Brothers.
Warner Brothers, and you were rigging. Were you working with your pop at the time, or?
No, they pretty much tried to keep the relatives
away from each other.
Yeah.
They didn't want to create any kind of...
I like to say I don't like nepotism, but we just tried to keep it in the family.
That's great.
We have four generations of electricians.
So four generations, that's probably more than anybody. It's your father, right. It's you,
right.
Your sons, and your grandsons are in the business.
Right.
That's phenomenal. And Jim Planet, was his father working with your dad?
It was a small group. So you pretty much worked with everyone at one time or another. One time you'd be a lamp operator, the next time you'd be the gaffer. It's just the way that it worked at the time. They tried to keep the people that they had trained for their system in place. So they had a studio preference roster on top of the regular roster. So you had seniority over not only all the group ones, but also any other lamp operators.
You're in 62, you're rigging at Warner Brothers. You get into the union in 65.
67.
67, so it took you 5 years to get into the union. And after you got in the union, were you rigging more? Did you start gaffing more?
I rigged for about 10 years, and I enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun.
So you were running mainly DC back then?
Right.
Yeah. Right? DC stages.
All the studios were DC.
Those Westinghouse big DC generators.
Yeah.
And so you're using paddle boxes at all at that time?
Yeah, plug-in boxes, they called them. And paddles was the plug.
And every arc had to have a lamp operator.
Yes.
To trim the carbons.
Right, yeah. You could only run a continuous for about 20 minutes.
Yeah, so you had to constantly be working on it. Yeah,
and that's why they continually would shut the lights down when they weren't filming. They didn't use it for rehearsals or anything like that. And that's where they came up with the lights, camera, action. Lights first, you had to strike your arcs, and they had to get the flicker out of it. The flicker was caused by cratering the carbons. When you closed them together, if you hit them too hard, you'd crater it, and then it would have to burn in. So it took a while for the lights to settle down and be able to shoot. And then it was camera, and they actually was the time when they were cranking it by hand. And then they'd bring on the action.
That's how lights, camera, action. And
then at the end of shooting a scene, they would kill everything. But it was highly controlled. They had to conserve the lighting systems. Even the incandescent globes that was invented by Thomas Edison for the motion picture industry, especially what would happen is the filament made of tungsten would burn off and deposit on the glass. So they had a carbon grit inside that you would actually shake the globe and clean the globe on the inside.
By shaking it?
Yeah.
This is before quartz, of course.
Yeah, oh yeah. Quartz lamp was an improvement. They considered the incandescent light an improvement over the arc. Until the quartz lamp was developed, they always had to clean the globes. Especially the key light, which was the main source of light on the set, they always made sure that they had the best globe cleaned up. They used to paint the key lights, which was usually a 2K, 5K, and a 10K. They had it painted white so that you knew that that light was your key light.
So those 10 years that you were rigging after 67, anybody notable that you worked with, gaffers or DPs or movie-wise, that stick out in your head?
They were all notable in one way or another. Jerry Boatwright was starting at the same time I was at Warner Brothers Studio. He later was the best boy for Doug Pentek. And head of Universal was Jimmy Phillips. The head of MGM was Fenton Hamilton. Bill Croft was the chief at Paramount. And Paramount is where I wound up working the most and enjoyed it the most. And actually, I went from rigger all the way up to chief of the studio.
And how long did that take you to do?
It was about 10 years.
10 years?
Yeah.
So you're working on the lot for 10 years, and an opening came up, and you threw your hat in the ring, or how did that happen?
No, I was pretty much asked to take the job. Usually, those positions are filled by guys off the rigging crew. You became a rigging gaffer, rigged for all the stages. At Universal, I worked for Bill Tenney, and we did the day crew, worked on the stages. And my brother ran the night crew, and they did all the exterior work. And my dad worked there as a gaffer. When I started working at Universal, of course, they said, well, boy, we're going to have a problem here. We've got too many Dahlquists on the lot. So I said, well, great, lay me off. I'll go somewhere else. They laid me off and went to MGM. And that was a great place to work. I mean, it was fun. I mean, quite frankly, if I had had a lot of money, I had paid them to work.
Wow, was that fun?
I mean, it was... You know, they had three back lots. You know, they had 30 sound stages, and it was a lot of fun.
So your chief at Paramount, that's got to be like around 1977. At the time, Mole Richardson was probably at the peak of their game and dominance in the industry, I imagine.
Yeah, pretty much so.
And so they were selling to you. And one of the gentlemen that we both know is Larry Parker. Larry Parker, of course, is Peter Mole's grandson.
Yes, he is. Warren Parker is
his son-in-law.
Son-in-law. And Larry is Warren Parker's
son. You're right. So, and you went to school with Larry.
Well, I went to the same school.
Right.
We started out in grammar school at St. Charles. I didn't know him until I actually got into the business.
Oh, I see. But you guys kind of hit it off because you knew a lot of the same people. It was a small world back then.
Right.
Mike Hodgins, you must have known as well.
Yeah.
And so they would call on you at Paramount from time to time, I bet, because you were a big customer.
Well, I wasn't the customer. Paramount was, but...
But you were in charge of spending the money.
Exactly. You know, and they were, at the time, had the top-of-the-line equipment. They were the standard of the industry. They had just developed the lightweight arc, which was a great improvement for going on location. I mean, they used to take... those lights weighed 250 pounds.
Jeez.
It was cast aluminum. It took at least 2 men. Usually, you had to put them on a stand. You had to use a hoist.
And that's not including the rectifier that you needed to haul with it.
Grid.
Oh, the grid, yeah.
Yeah, the grid was a resistor.
Which is sort of like a ballast today for some people that don't know what that is.
Yeah, it's similar. Mm-hmm. What it did was it put resistance in the line to lower the voltage so that the carbon wouldn't burn at 120 volts. So they had to drop the voltage down. So they used a grid, which was just a resistor, a big heater.
You buy these carbon arcs and you're working at Paramount, and then there's a moment where you decided that you're going to leave Paramount and pursue a business, right?
Well, yeah, that all came about when I met Wally Mills, and he was the president of LTM.
Before he opened up City Mills, right. He was the president of LTM USA.
Correct. And I met him in 1975. The way that we met was they were doing a John Wayne commercial for Great Western Bank on Western Street. Frankly, Nettie was the gaffer.
Oh, wow.
Called up and said that they needed 50 amps of AC out on Western Street. And I said, well, Frank, what for? You've got 5,000 amps of DC out there. You know, what do you need the AC for? He said, well, we got a new light and it needs AC. So went out there. We got the 50 amps of AC, and he had two 2,500 ambiarcs.
Oh, so they actually did make ambiarc.
Yeah.
Hmm.
They had both. They had a soft light, and then they had the Fresnel lights, which the Fresnel lights were preferred. And Mole had come out with a HMI, and it was kind of a copy of the Cobalt.
Yeah, Cobalt eventually turned into a company called Braun, or bought out by Braun, but I remember Cobalt back in the day. One of the first HMI manufacturers. So they must have worked with Osram back then to develop that bulb.
Osram developed the HMI globe.
So what year did you see these first AC, which we probably know as the genesis of HMI?
1975. So they were going to do the commercial, and they lit these HMI lights, and John Wayne was going to do his lines, and he said, where the hell have those lights been all my life? Because he'd been used to staring into carbon-burning arcs, which was a very harsh...
Hard to do.
...to look into. You know, not only was it hot, but it also is a very harsh light. So I said, oh, my God, this is going to change the business, you know, if these things become popular. So I got a hold of Wally Mills. I asked Frank, I said, where'd you get these? He says, well, he says, there's a company called LTM. The president is Wally Mills. So I called him up and said, Wally, I want to take a look at these HMI lights that you've got. So he brought over all of the different sizes that they had at the time. I think the largest one was 2,500 watt. I said, I don't know much about these lights when he brought them over. He says, well, that's okay. He says, I don't either. I said, well, we'll learn together. I said, great, because he had been selling Moviola editing machines. It was just a product that he had picked up. They asked him, you know, oh, as long as you're going to these studios with these editing machines, how about just taking these lights, see what you can do with them. So that's how we were introduced and got together.
And you were at Paramount this time?
I was at Paramount, yeah. And like you said earlier, everything was DC. So it was a tremendous conversion from DC to AC. And I had very little background with AC.
As most did.
So I took an electrical technology class at Pasadena City College at night and learned as much as I could about AC.
Oh, that's fantastic. So you saw this tech, this HMI tech, and you knew this was going to be a big hit.
Yeah, because they had been trying to replace the carbon-burning arc with different light sources because the arc was big, heavy. It took one man to operate it.
Yeah, it was just expensive. But arguably still the best-looking quality of light.
Yeah, and that's how the term lamp operator came about because you had the carbon-burning, it was a flame inside, so it was a lamp.
So now we get into a little bit of the drama, maybe, because you're talking to Wally Mills, who was a really great friend of mine as well as yours. But you knew him, of course, a lot longer than me. He mentored me quite a bit. And actually, a lot of people don't know this. He was very close to being a partner of mine in Macam. We had many discussions about that, and we almost did it. I regret not. But here comes the drama now. So Moe Richardson kind of owns the town, and here's this new company coming in from France and selling these HMIs, and Moe must have come up with, they came up, like you said, with the cobalt version, like an open face, not a Fresnel. And so now you're put in a position as the Paramount chief of which of these fixtures you're going to buy, and it must have been a heavy decision.
We had bought one set of HMIs from Moe Richardson, but when the Fresnel lights came out, everybody wanted that Fresnel light.
So that's what you had to do. So getting back to Warren Parker and Larry Parker on the arcs, you noticed a problem with them.
What happened when they started building the lightweight Brute, they used the negative that they used on the baby Brute, which was 2 inches shorter than the regular negative. In order to get it into that size body, they had to alter that. So when they built the lightweight Brute, they used that short negative. The short negative cost more than the long negative, and you could only buy it through Moe Richardson. So, I mean, we used to buy the long negatives and cut them with a hacksaw. But,
you know, I mean, and it worked fine.
Yeah, but, you know, you don't always have a hacksaw.
Right.
When you get a box of carbon, you can't sit there
and saw them all day.
Exactly. We took a look at the negative carriage on the old 170 arcs. And we modified it so that we could fit that into the lightweight Brute. We had a problem with them flickering, and it was because they had inadvertently left off one of the conductive straps that went over the brushes. So we sent the arcs back to Moe for repair. And when they got there, they noticed that they had the 170 negatives in there. So he called me up, Warren Parker.
The president of Moe, the son of Peter Moe, summons you to the office.
Yes.
What are you doing?
He says, you've modified these arcs, that's why they're flickering. And I says, no, I don't think so. And I said, the reason that they're flickering is you didn't install the top of the brushes and a strap of silver conductor strap on it so that both sides of the brushes were energized. So anyhow, he says, they won't work with these 170 negatives. And I says, well, yeah, they will. No, he says, let me explain it to you. I says, okay. He says, the 170 arc runs at 3/4 of an inch gap. The way that the carbon-burning arc works is you touch the two together, and then you draw them apart enough you actually draw an arc. To maintain that arc, you have to have it set at a specific distance from one another. Well, the brute uses a one-inch gap. He says, you see, he says, the 170 will give you 3/4 inch gap, but the brute arc takes 1-inch gap. He says, it won't work together. I says, yeah, it will. It's all you got to do is take the worm gear, drive out, and elongate that shaft, cut the hole longer. I said, then you've got the 1-inch. It kind of upset him. We had the blueprints of the brute.
Laid out on his desk.
Yeah, and he just rolled them up and turned on his heels and walked away.
And walked away.
So that was my first irritation with Warren Parker. Right.
And then your second one, of course, is now you're buying these supposedly foreign lights from France.
He was upset about that.
Yeah.
Any manufacturer that doesn't like to lose a customer. You know, he said, well, he said, we're coming up with Vanilla Lens HMIs. I said, great. When you get them ready, let me know. I'm only buying what the gaffer is.
Yeah. This is true today.
Yeah. It's not me. It's what the gaffers want.
Right. Was that a big decision for you in creating a rental company? And
it's what encouraged me to start a rental company, because they were expensive lights. All the studios were reluctant to buy these, so they were renting them from places that had them.
Right. We take it for granted that you actually could buy lights today, but back then you actually couldn't even buy them.
No.
You started one of the first big rental houses in the United States, probably in the world, sort of like the first MBS, where you had multiple locations, and it was called Keylight.
Yes.
And who was your partner in Keylight?
That was Ed Carlin.
Ed Carlin.
I was asked to rig a set down at MGM Studios. And like I said, you know, they held on to their employees. And once you left one studio, it was hard to get back in because you weren't on the preference list anymore. But they were doing King Kong, and they had some huge sets to rig. And the rigging gaffer on the set, who used to work for me on the rigging crew at Paramount, called me. He says, hey, Ron, he says, can you come over? He says, this is just too damn big. He says, I don't know where to start. Can you come over here and help me rig these two sets? And I said, well, okay, if I can get permission to leave.
Right.
I did get the okay to leave Paramount for a short time and work on King Kong.
And King Kong was shot here at MGM?
Yeah.
Man, what a huge outdoor set, imagine.
Yeah, at the time it was. You know, I was supposed to be there 2 weeks, and I wound up being there 11 months.
That's why you said it was really fun to work on that lot.
It was. And it was a great picture. It was fun to work on it. I wound up being best boy and rigging gaffer. Richard Klein was the cameraman.
So that's where you met Ed Carlin on this best scene for him.
Yeah, we had 5 stages and 2 back lots rigged. And we had a crew of 1-1 and 48.
Wow.
A chroma key backing at the time was probably the largest, which was 50 foot high and 100 foot long. And we had to light the chroma key backing so that they could put the image. They had a hand rigged on a crane where Jessica Lange sat in to go through the waterfall.
Oh, wow, right.
So we had to light that backing. And at the time, the town was really busy. Dino De Laurentiis was doing, I think, 3 features at the same time. E.T. was being shot. There was a lot of big features going on at the same time. So we were running out of people, literally picking people off the street to work. I mean, they didn't know what an arc looked like,
wow,
much less run ones.
That must have been tough for you.
Well, it was, but it was fun, too.
Yeah, because you got to teach everybody.
Yeah, and we'd hold class every day.
So Ed Carlin really appreciated you. He saw your talents, and then after this show, you guys decided, hey, let's buy some LTM lights and rent them?
Almost that way. Again, they were running out of equipment in Hollywood. MGM had some equipment that was really old and rugged. So I said, well, why don't we rent some from Paramount? Because I have a lot of those on the lot. So that was how the Paramount rental actually started.
That's interesting. So before, the studios used to be pretty self-sufficient and they wouldn't sub-rent from each other.
Right.
And this is the first time where you guys kind of brokered a deal between 2 studios to start rentals. And that actually, a big light bulb or brood arc went over light up over your head?
Yeah, it did. I've always had an entrepreneurial side to me. Even when I started in the business, I had a side business keep me going during the slow times and all. So Ed Carlin had already started a business.
So you and Ed Carlin make this company Key Light. How long did Key Light go for?
15 years.
15 years. One of the biggest rental companies in North America. How many employees did you guys have?
At one time, we had 105
employees. 105 employees.
Five different locations.
Where are the locations at?
Salt Lake City, Phoenix, Minneapolis, Dallas, Texas, and L.A.
So was Key Light back then able to buy Mole Richardson fixtures?
We did, in a way.
Not directly, then?
No, we would order them through some of their dealers because we couldn't buy it direct. Of course, they caught on to that. That's like having a secret password to buy a Ford automobile.
and they were worried because they only had sold to studios and you guys sort of competed with their rental business, I guess.
Yes. Yeah, that was the rub.
That was the rub. So they didn't sell you lights, but you did. You guys found a way to buy them from dealers.
From their dealers.
Throughout the country and just ship them back.
Ship them back, right.
So were you guys working and gaffing the gear or just renting it? I imagine you guys were working it.
Well, we did a few things, but you can't gaff and run a business at the same time. So we did some special jobs that were called on. We lit the backstage at the White House. We did it at Reagan's neighbor's ranch. It wasn't...
Oh, in Santa Ynez.
Yeah, it was not his ranch because the security wasn't good enough. So we did it at the neighbor's ranch.
Interesting.
And Merle Haggard was a guest performer. He owed Reagan a debt. He got him out of jail, pardoned him. So.
Oh, no kidding.
But that was payback for him. We let the B-1B bomber roll out.
So you didn't have to do a lot of big movies on lot. You found other ways to rent your fixtures. And
yeah, we didn't do any features or anything. We did, some rock and roll shows. We did Cal Jam 2.
Right.
That was crazy. That was lit with arcs.
No kidding. So the heydays of Key Light is like the 80s then.
Yeah.
It comes into the 90s, and this is about the time where you guys sell Key Light to the Matthews Group back then.
Correct.
And they were a big conglomerate. They were trying to spread their wings throughout the whole United States. And then that kind of propelled you into manufacturing. How did you get into manufacturing?
Well, I started manufacturing at Key Light because, again, we couldn't buy some of the equipment that we needed. So I said, well, okay, I'll just make it.
That must have been a tough conversation with you because Larry was your friend.
He understood. He says, well, my dad. And I said, okay. Now the problem was is you're just going to build a competitor.
Right.
So you have a need for something you can't buy.
You're just going to make it.
Yourself.
So you started making parts,
yeah,
and that's what got you into manufacturing.
Yeah.
When did you start Dadco, the distribution company?
In 93, we sold Key Light to the Matthews Group. Part of the deal was I wasn't part of the deal. So I started manufacturing portable power distribution. Basically took the mold design of a lunchbox that they had made, so I modified it and started making them out of aluminum. This date, we've sold about 10,000 of those units.
Wow.
We were making a complete line of tungsten lights, and Airy started to use these PAR lights. They had modified the PAR lights. Sunray had a line of PAR lights, so it took lenses. You had to put lenses in front of the light source, which was, the bigger it got, the heavier it got, the more cumbersome it got. And Airy came out with a design for
the faceted reflector.
I said, well, gee, I ought to be able to make that.
Right?
So competition is always good.
That's right. It's what a very colorful, beautiful career that you've had here. Legacy, legendary gaffer. Your father used to work with Jim Planet's father. Used to go to the racetrack with Peter Mole. I mean, you were really tied into this industry and having your little battles big battles with Mole Richardson to try to get parts and propelled you into manufacturing.
That just made it interesting.
It made it more interesting.
I'm not through yet. So.
No, and you're not done. And actually, I still see that, when we go to the trade shows, doesn't seem like there's any kind of animosity because I'll see Mike Parker come up to you and you guys will chat. And
there never was.
There never was.
It was... you know, friendly competition.
It was friendly competition.
The industry has really been good to me and to my family, and I'm very fortunate. It isn't about the money necessarily. My dad told me when I first got in this business, he said, if you're in it for just for the money, he says, go out and rob a bank. It's a lot easier. So every day has been an adventure. Participate in the evolution of the lighting from the carbon burning arc.
All the way to the fluorescence, too, with Frieder.
Yeah, fluorescence, now LED. It's been great. And if you don't embrace technology, you're going to be lost.
Right. And you've done that continuously from brood arcs to fluorescence to HMIs to LEDs. You're one of the first adopters to all this new technology. Did you find it more difficult these days to be in the lighting industry than it was back in the day?
It's definitely.
It's more difficult, yeah.
A lot more knowledge. You know, it's not just tip up, tip down, squat and flood. You have to know a lot more.
Yeah, it's the barrier to making an LED these days is incredible. I remember I worked for Gilles, who, of course, used to work at LTM. To make an HMI, it wasn't that difficult.
I got a story about Gilles.
Oh, I got to hear it. You know, he was a mentor. I worked with him for 10 years.
Okay, so when Wally first, we got together and started looking at it, I said, you know, there's some changes that you need to make on these lights to be really accepted. And I said, it may sound stupid, you know, but it's things like you're mounting the spud. It's the position of the ears on the light. It's those things that the end user wants. So he said, would you come to the factory and tell them that and show them what you need? I said, oh, I'd love to. So I made the trip to Paris.
Oh, you did? Wow.
Yeah. Gilles was just a kid floating around the warehouse.
Right.
And his dad, John, was the president of the company. We had gone through, you know, the modifications, which actually came out to be the Mark II and Mark III versions.
No kidding.
L change.
So what, they flew you to Paris?
Yeah.
Wow, LTM flew you to Paris.
Yeah. Had a great time and went through the factory. And we started, you know, just talking about, they had an incandescent line that they were trying to push too. And I said, well, you got tough competition there.
Right.
I said, you got, you know, companies that have been established for more than 50 years. I wouldn't suggest it. But we're sitting there at his desk, and I said, if you want to make a bunch of lights, I says, make that one. And what it was a little model of a tiny light on the pedestal. And he laughed. And he says, there's no photometrics. I says, it doesn't matter. I says, make 1,000 of them. I'll buy them myself. I said, because the small little lights, there's a market for it.
So that's a 200-watt HMI sun gun?
No, that's the peppers.
Oh, the peppers. You're talking about the tungsten, of course. Man, the peppers was wildly popular line. It still actually sells today. Yes. So you...
It all came out of sitting at his desk. He says, they made that in the warehouse for just to have on the desk.
Yeah.
I said, well, just make 1,000 of them. I says,
and you'll buy them.
A good start.
They were really great to work with, the peppers. They were so easy to change the bulbs, the way that it opened up on the top.
And actually, when Jill came over here, he actually came over to replace Wally.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So, and that's why Wally went to his own business.
So that's when Wally started CMC. Oh, so... Oh, poor Gilles was put into a situation where he had to ace out poor Wally and then compete with him.
Yeah.
Oh, that must have been tough.
Yeah. So Wally was making some HMI lights, and they were all typical fabrication look called Sunburst.
The Sunburst.
Yeah. He had a crazy guy that did his fabrication work in Arizona, Joe Brown.
He was nuts.
That was a story. So anyhow, they were fabricating the housings for him, you know, kind of a squared off affair. He actually saw the lightweight Brute, and at the time, you couldn't buy lightweight Brutes.
That's right. Mole rat.
Would not
sell them to you, yeah.
And the way that I got around that, the original lightweight arc was started at Paramount. We used to have a sheet metal shop in there, and they made something which we called the Wainco.
The Wainco.
Wainco. It was called the Golden Eagle because it was aluminum, but when the mold line came out, it killed them. But they had all these arcs there, the arc body, and they were 170s.
Right.
So the way that I got carbon burning arcs is I bought all the
Paramount ones. Paramount. Yeah.
All the old.
Oh wow.
Paramount. We had a lot of excess lights. I went to Terry White. I said, Terry, what are you doing with all those baby brutes? He said, I'd like to get rid of them. I says, well, I'd like to buy them. And I got about 10 of those baby brutes, and I took the Wainco housings.
All right.
Took the guts out of that, put the baby brute housing, baby brutes into the.
Oh, wow, incredible.
I had lightweight arcs, and Mola could never figure out
where you got them.
Where I got the arcs. And we'd have six shows out, you know, and where are they getting these arcs? And
they'd rent for pretty good money.
Oh, yeah, well, it was part of the package. You had, if you didn't have arcs on there, and you couldn't sub rent them from them.
So if you didn't have arcs, you weren't, yeah, you weren't doing a gig.
Nobody else had them. Mole wouldn't sell them. We were one of the few that had lightweight arcs. And that's what helped grow our business, our rental business. And then, again, when the HMIs came out and we jumped on the bandwagon with the HMIs, and that, you know, just took the business a little further.
So there's a lot of your fixtures that are still out on sets working, and your modified film gear ones, and I'm sure the 24K is actually probably still renting because I see them a lot.
That wasn't film gears.
That was Wally and you and the Sunray design.
Right, and then we designed the first 18K faceted par. Ari had made it where it took two people to load the globe in, and because you had to load it from the front, we designed lamp that you could load it from the rear, just like, you know, the HMI door on the 18 case.
So the new line of DACO power distribution is got data management as well.
Correct.
So you're doing RDM wireless distro boxes,
right?
And Ethernet, yeah. And all this is really just starting in the past few years to really kind of take off because of all the LED lights that we're using now.
Yeah, all the lights they have the control built right into the lights.
Yeah, and so for you guys don't know this out there, DADCO makes a line called the Black Cat, right?
Correct.
Yeah, the Black Hat is their data power distribution line. It's getting quite popular, and it's also made by a legendary man in the business, Ron Dahlquist. He'll even sign it for you if you buy enough of them.
There you go.
You've touched more lives in the industry than you know, and here's, you know, one of them where, you know, my grandson actually has a father that's employed in the union, you know, partly because of you. And so I can't thank you enough, and the industry's very grateful for you. Hey, Ash, can you come here for a second? This is Ron Dahlquist, who got your husband into the union.
Yeah, Michael.
Yeah, so you know him. So anyways, folks, man, Ron, this has been a really great conversation. I can't tell you how much I appreciate you coming in and sharing the history of this industry and your knowledge. And I hope that we can get you back soon, because I think there's a whole lot more to talk about, but we only have a limited amount of time. So anyways, get everybody, Ron Dahlquist, legend in the industry. Thank you for coming on, Ron.
Thank you for joining us today, and please don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Macam Inc. or visit our website at www.macam.tv. I'm Mac from Macam, where it's easy and delightful to spend your money on the latest technology.